When I look at myself, I forget to learn. When I look at the world, I learn to listen. When I look at God, I listen to learn. Sri Chinmoy. Chapter 8. Stop, Look and Listen. It would take more than reading a book. I had enough experience of study to know any real headway would require peers for company, as well as someone to explain things in speech, someone who really knew what they were talking about, who could give examples and answer questions, not someone like me bluffing my way through a technical meeting at work. Looking for an outer manifestation of my inner guide did not even occur to me. He surely only belonged in my imagination. Ordinary human beings would do fine as long as they knew a little more than I did. I picked up a local magazine I had seen on the counters of bookshops and cafes. After some singles columns and strange poems, ads for pubs and jobs and churches, festivals and foreign films, crystal healing and space clearing and kung fu, was a tiny coloured photograph of an Indian man. Under it in tinier type was Meditation Course at Clifton Library, based on the teachings of Sri Chinmoy. Free entry. It was due to start that evening in the next road from my own, but still I was not sure my efforts would be well invested. Maybe I should do my laundry instead, I thought. Actually, I think I'm getting a cold. Maybe I'll go to the next one. It'll probably finish late as well, and then I'll be tired for work. So maybe I'll just go for the start and see what it's like. Or maybe not. Unknown to me at the time, the advertisement was unique, the only one placed by the Sri Chinmoy Centre in that magazine for years before and after. If I had waited for the next time, it would not have arrived, and I probably would not have remembered the name well enough to pursue it further. My real hurdle was shyness, not laundry. Despite all my life experiences, in new social situations I was straight back in school, longing to be invisible but instead sticking out like a traffic cone. To avoid getting too comfortable at home, I forced myself to go straight from work, intending to perch somewhere discreet like a bird on a fence, with the option of flying off again. Anxious not to be late, I inadvertently got there half an hour early and tried to creep in silently at the back of the crowd. Creeping silently is not so easy in high heels, and the attempt itself proved fruitless anyway. The room was empty except for two fellows about my age. They had just begun setting out the chairs, so the only ones available were at the front. I twisted my mouth into something that was supposed to be a smile. The two fellows had already produced their own smiles easily. One of them handed me a sheet of writing, which I clung to as if for my life, glad just to have an occupation. Folding myself as small as I could into a chair, I glared down at the page. Reading was out of the question. I could only let my heart thunder on while my own inner hope repeated itself like a mantra. Please don't talk to me. At least the room had filled up once the class began. Having sat still for half an hour, though, I was already wrestling with the urge to stand, or at least to wriggle around. I thus became more absorbed by my plastic chair than by meditation, wondering if the designer had ever sat in its prototype for more than a few moments. On top of a desk was a larger version of the photograph I had seen in the magazine, a smiling Indian man who was apparently Sri Chinmoy. There was another picture, but as it faced slightly away from me, the light reflected on its surface, so I could not see it clearly. Still cringing with shyness in my front row seat, I did not pay much attention to anything outside myself at first. I tried to listen as an exercise unfolded, but caught my eyes studying a tape mark on the painted wall instead, and began wondering what had been fastened there. Then I pondered how the speaker came to wear that particular shirt on that particular day. It was explained that the mind, although a useful tool for life on earth, does not know how to find peace. By diving into the heart during meditation, we can let the mind rest from its constant chatter, thus renewing our inspiration and energy. In truth, I dared not study the contents of my heart as the exercise required, for fear they would either be too plain or too intoxicating. "What will I do tomorrow?" asked my mind instead. "What would I have done yesterday if..." The carpet was thin and cheerless. The light was grey and flickering. The speaker spoke, and the chair grew in stubbornness. Musical instruments were carried in from one side. Lungs know air without cerebral confirmation. They drink their fill instinctively. Leaves know the sun and stretch their bellies out to it. So it always was for me with ripe berries or my mother's baking. Every cell of me said yes to them with complete abandon. Each is an elemental response, a recognition of source, an ancient resonance beyond the mechanics of questioning. So it was with that music. I thought I had known beauty. I knew I had heard music, reams and reams and reels of it, but it had never reached such depths in me. Seated on the floor, with voice and simple Indian instruments, the two young Englishmen offered Sri Chinmoy's Bengali songs. The words meant nothing to my own English ear. Perhaps one string was too tight, or a note stumbled here and there, but that meant nothing either. I only knew my heart and that music in an endless now. It seemed there was no mind to demand and no body to take requests. I knew no imperfection, no bounds within or without, but sensed my own self with sudden clarity and certainty. Tears cascaded to my easy smile. Of all places, in that uncomfortable plastic chair, I was free. I was meditating. At the end of the class, people left or milled around, drinking the juice and nibbling the biscuits the two young men served, as if they had not already given enough. I did not move or speak for some time, but eventually noticed a table of books. There were prices on handmade labels, so I knew they were for sale. I wanted to buy one to show my gratefulness and to have some means of encouragement at home, but suddenly remembered I was shy and scuffled out the door instead. I slept like an infant as soon as my head touched the pillow, just as I had done on the night of the metal bridge. All the world felt safe and yielding. I returned on one or two more evenings, but outside Clifton Library I forgot too easily the appeal of meditation lessons. Fireworks night and a couple of dinner invitations easily jostled their way past spirituality in the ranks of my priorities. Sri Chinmoy himself was giving a concert in Edinburgh around that time, and those attending classes were invited to go along. I was baffled that anyone would travel 400 miles for a musical performance, and did not even consider it. My initial experience was almost forgotten. But having nothing else to do one day after work, I thought about returning to what I assumed would be some relaxing exercises at Clifton Library. Perhaps they would involve the bloom of a flower, or the head of a candle, and maybe some music. I first decided they would be easy once I applied myself, so I did not really need to go. I had a candle and flower in a special place at home, so I could just continue practicing at 6 in the morning, and again before bed, as the instructors had suggested. Although I followed all their advice to the letter, my mind wandered more freely at home. At least away from the lure of television and domestic chores, I would focus myself more readily, and would probably get a good night's sleep afterwards into the bargain. So I finally launched myself out into the wintry night. The two photographs were reversed. The smiling one was to the side and the other looked out from the middle of the desk. It was a face in black and white, not immediately recognisable as the same Indian man, but nonetheless a portrait of Sri Chinmoy, known as his transcendental picture. The camera's glance conveyed the direct blaze of his eyes in a deep state of meditation. It was explained there is a level of consciousness that transcends all desire and earthly identity, known as God realization or self-realization. This is the ultimate goal of meditation, the highest level of self-discovery, conscious awareness of one's own unity with God. Seen as a game of hide and seek, the world is God's camouflage and our part is to find him. By identifying oneself with someone, or even a picture of someone, who has attained this level of awareness, one can potentially receive or increase any divine quality, as from the boundless universe itself. One can also gain a closer understanding of God and a clearer sense of his presence in the self and in the world at large. After calming our breath and letting go the tensions of the day, we were invited to rest our gaze on the face as we had done with a flame or a rose. Like all the techniques we had been taught, this one would employ the heart, not the physical or emotional heart, but the spiritual heart in the middle of the chest, where one feels most joy and identification. I had sensed a tingling there during previous exercises, like the press of many tiny fingers. Sometimes it was more a sweet ache, like the stretch of a bowstring. Even without such sensations, focusing on that area in myself brought a tangible awareness of peace, safety, surety, and familiarity. While it was not enough for me to be told a place or practice is safe, the theory corresponded with my own instinct and experience, so I knew enough to trust it. I opened my eyes halfway, but imagined I was looking from the heart, as I had learned. "There you are," I called out in silence. It was him, the very same man, my inner guide, right there in a real photograph. The same eyes containing the depth of galaxies, the same almost imperceptible smile. I knew straight away, but the face grew in clarity and affinity, gently yet unmistakably, as if coming to me through a sea haze. With wave after wave of tearful relief, I knew I had found home at last. It had been inside my own heart all along. I did not want the feeling to end, for him to disappear again as though back into the mist. Could he not stay with me always? Even at the close of the exercise, my eyes refused to leave that face, as dear and familiar as my own. Anger nipped me suddenly, anger at myself. Why had I not gone to the concert in Edinburgh? I would gladly have travelled such a short distance to see him. Who could tell when he would come again, if ever? People were milling about, drinking juice and nibbling biscuits. At last I could not let my own shyness shackle me. Hungry for the outer words of my inner guide, I bought a book called Meditation, Man Perfection in God Satisfaction. I searched the table for a copy of the photograph to take home, but there were none to be seen. My bravery was already exhausted in the first transaction, so I dared not ask further. It was the last evening of the course. Those wanting to continue could meet the following week at a cafe, one of many private businesses known as Divine Enterprises, run by disciples of Sri Chinmoy around the world. I felt sure the photographs would be for sale there, displayed on shelves in various sizes. "Yes," repeated itself in me each time I turned a page in my new book, Sri Chinmoy's explanations of seemingly inexplicable spiritual mysteries matched inner inklings that were already my own. His concepts seemed perfectly blossomed versions of closed buds in myself. Even his writings on God, the taboo subject of my childhood, were clear yet poetic, simple yet profound. all without the dryness of a scientific mind, but only a vast heart, at once far sweeter and more compelling than any intellectual argument. Of all the names for God, I learned his favourite was Supreme, conveying a state of constantly transcending perfection instead of some fixed height or depth. Depending on the individual mission of each soul, I learned that many different roads could lead to that one ever-evolving goal. A guru, literally one who illumines, one who destroys darkness and ignorance, is one who can lead to that goal, as he has already made the journey himself. A God-realized spiritual master's ascent is complete. He has reached the summit. Thus, freed from desire, he lives only for those still climbing. Rather than teaching me spirituality like a foreign language, Sri Chinmoy's words, and even his very existence, were reminding me of it all in myself, as if it only lay under lifetimes of forgetfulness. I was like an ancient vessel, buried in the earth for many ages, that he was lifting up and polishing, only to bring out its original luster and fill it with clear water again. A year since I had returned to England, the air held the sparkle and suspense of Christmas. Bubbles had moved to a house in Bath, and I found a flat off White Ladies Road with a girl from work. Alison was round and jolly. Unless she was sleeping, she talked constantly, to me, to herself, or on the phone. I often crept around so as not to be seen, but it was not a large flat, so she could easily lasso me with her one-way conversation, even without leaving the sofa or the kitchen table. The entire bathroom was the colour of an overripe avocado, including the carpet, which bothered me more than it should have. Although I still did not have the deposit to buy my own flat, Alison's talking and a bathroom that never looked clean, even when it was, spurred me on to save harder for it than ever. The cafe where the classes were to continue was in Montpellier, on the far side of Redland and far outside my geographical comfort zone. I arrived early and hunkered in the car to see if other people would go in first. The windows were papered with large posters to block out distractions from the road during meditation. The unknown interior was thus almost more than my shyness could surmount, and I wondered several times whether to just drive away. At 5 minutes to the start, a figure came in silhouette, tried the door, and disappeared within. Another two came together and did the same. Finally, I forced myself to follow. It was a long, thin room with tables stacked up at one end and a pale blue rug rolled out at the other. A little English lady sat there on the ground wearing an Indian sari and attending a harmonium like the one I had heard in the library. Four or five others were chatting, but they turned to smile and watch me enter. The lady beckoned me to join her and I practically ran there for cover. It looked the friendliest and least conspicuous place. Behind on a table was the black and white photograph I had thirsted to see again. I remember none of the words from the talk, but there was music, which we were all allowed to sing. Simple songs repeated in beguiling echoes that I did not want to end. The lady made chords that pulled on my heart like the clasped hand of a playmate. Her own voice was clear yet quiet, full of the same happy tenderness I had seen in her eyes. By subtle glances, she noted how the music touched me, and we continued for a long time. Sri Chinmoy was talking and meditating then on a video screen. I was loath to miss an instant by blinking, but my tears gave me no choice. I had never heard my inner guide's voice, neither the warmth of it nor the music of its Indian tones. His clothing made him all the more vibrant and real, yet still otherworldly. He wore an Indian dhoti kurta, a long tunic and a separate length of cloth wrapped around the legs and waist. It was in a much brighter shade than the earth colours of a conventional renunciate, and it was satin too, I noticed, not cotton. He played an esraj, a long bowed instrument I had never seen. The sound seemed to call from another realm, and I wished it would never end. I was like a child first discovering her father is not only her father, but has a whole working life as well, as a doctor or a janitor or a watchmaker. I had only really known his silent wisdom up to then, but Sri Chinmoy was a sportsman, a painter and songwriter, a poet and playwright, humorist and humanitarian. He was also a treasured friend to so many more than just me, to stars, royals, presidents and Olympians, people I would never dream of meeting. The lady had made us soup. She brought out a nourishing grainy sort of bread and lots of butter too. Her kindness was almost more than I could receive at once. Each of the centre members had a similar robust willingness and a natural smile, but they were each very different in other ways, like cousins in a wide extended family. We made a long table from a few smaller ones pushed together. Sitting there with a cup of chamomile tea, I realised my shyness had evaporated. I belonged. On a shelf by the counter were Sri Chinmoy's books for sale, but I could not see the photograph I craved to own. Having been given so much already, I did not dare ask more, but the lady seemed to read me anyway. It would take me some time to realise such meditation centres need different qualities from their leaders than most other organisations do. The lady with the harmonium was the leader of Bristol Sri Chinmoy Centre, but her gentleness and humility had not let that possibility arise in my mind. "You liked the music, didn't you?" Her eyes all but disappeared in a twinkling grin. "Oh yes, thank you." "You like meditating on the transcendental picture too?" "Oh yes, very much." "Let me give you something," she asked, as if it were my favour to receive, not hers to offer. In case I denied her that joy, she had already tiptoed like a sprite down a narrow flight of stairs and returned with a colour photograph. "One day you can have your own. This is for you until then." Part of me did not dare touch a thing so sacred, but most of me claimed it like a child, claiming her father's wealth as her own. It was not a transcendental picture. Sri Chinmoy looked halfway between the two photographs I had seen in the classes, as if smiling and meditating at the same time. My next thought had already been anticipated too, and I was handed an envelope in which to keep it safe. "You choose your own frame, whatever you like best," she said. I could only smile. Words seemed coarse and empty. Only music or silence could have said what I meant, but the lady seemed to know. I did not open the envelope again until everything could be done with due ceremony. The next day I chose a new frame, hand-painted in Persia, with little blue buds and green leaves edged in gold. I hoped Sri Chinmoy would like it. Next time I saw the lady, I would ask her if he might. After bathing and choosing clean clothes, I slid the photograph behind the freshly buffed glass, setting it first in one special place and then another. At last I sat down to meditate, looking into the face from my heart. Sri Chinmoy's smile appeared to broaden in tandem with my own. "This is a drop of peace," I thought I heard him say, inside my heart, not in my ears. "Only a drop?" I asked in silence. Both our smiles seemed to grow again at my outrageous cheek and greed. The drop in my heart was like a golden bead of light that grew to fill not only me but also the space around me, the way a tiny bulb can illumine a room. A drop of peace was clearly more than I could use, at least for the time being. I wore it like a secret garment for the rest of the day. A new face appeared at the cafe one evening. A visitor from another Sri Chinmoy Centre had come to teach us how to blend art with meditation. I had seen a slideshow of Sri Chinmoy's Jhana Kala, or fountain art paintings. At first I did not notice much in them, but I was only looking with my ordinary human eyes. As soon as I gazed out from my heart, the way I had learned, the life in the pictures dazzled me such that I did not want to take my attention from them. I almost did not want to breathe, for fear that new and subtle vision might wing away like a startled bird. I wondered then that even for a novice like me, meditation might reawaken my long-lost creativity and even open new worlds of it. We wore old shirts back to front, like in preschool, and against my perfectionist nature I was soon daubing a page with multicoloured paint more freely than I had done since that age. We drew then without viewing the page at all, but only resting our gaze on a flower as if from our hearts. The results were beguiling, seemingly from parts of ourselves we had never tried to use. I had faith enough that the road of meditation would lead me to happiness, albeit a less glamorous and obvious road than the ones I had tried. Others would have other routes to their own happiness via different paths, but this was my way home. I knew, as surely as I could know anything, that Sri Chinmoy was my true spiritual teacher. I saw him then as my mountain guide, showing me the swiftest route to my own destined peak, pointing out the shortcuts as well as the pitfalls along the way. Not only was he a master, an expert teacher such as one would follow for proficiency in music or martial arts, but my master. It had become a custom for a few of us to stay late into the evening after a class, chatting and drinking tea. Mostly it was a chance for us to glean stories and answers about Sri Chinmoy and his teachings. For my part, I also did not want to leave a place that felt more welcoming than the flat where I actually lived. One night after watching a video of Sri Chinmoy's sporting activities, the conversation turned to running. "I hate running," I said, without apology. I boasted then that my strength had mysteriously improved since I had started meditation classes. Although I was no longer obsessive about training at the gym, I had almost regained the same fitness as I had before, just through the enjoyment of it. "Fitness helps meditation, and meditation helps fitness," came a gentle response. "Running is like meditation for the physical. It clears the mind and keeps the body fit, both of which are helpful spiritually. Sri Chinmoy recommends running above any other exercise, as long as you're strong and well enough to run." The proviso was not enough excuse for me, as I had just proven with my bragging. I remembered running with my mother every morning, the affinity with nature, the clean exhilaration, the glowing start to the day that no other start could match. I sulked in silence then, knowing it was true. Bristol Half Marathon was due in May, so I signed up the next day and went out for a frosty jog. I returned to the cafe frequently over the following month and was welcomed like an old friend, either for lunch at the weekends or at meditation evenings. I knew there would come a time when even those classes would end, but I assumed I could join the centre then officially. To the six of us remaining at the close of the course, it was explained that indeed we could apply to become one of Sri Chinmoy's students, or disciples as he called them. I would need to write a letter to him personally and send a photograph of myself. By meditating on my picture, he would be able to determine whether or not I was ready for the spiritual life, and if so, whether or not he was meant to be my guru. I had felt sure of both answers even before I knew his name, but the thought of an outer confirmation thrilled me beyond all hope or expression.